and he will present us his recent results of fertilization after his fertile became some percentage persons.
Thanks for the introduction. It's a great pleasure to be at Perimeter. I'd especially like to thank Rob Myers for the invitation. So what I'm going to talk about is thermalization after inflation and the impact of the supersonic. The outline of the talk is as following. After a brief introduction, I will describe the issue and then how the situation is modified in a supersymmetric theories. And then an important cosmological consequence of thermalization, modification of thermalization in supersymmetry, which is the particle production of the early universe. I will also conclude by comparing with another regime after inflation, and also making some comments about how these considerations can be applied to some models of brain after brain inflation, which people like Rick Burgess and Rob Myers at the Perimeter work on. A very brief history of the universe in the Big Bang picture. Here we are after about 15 billion years, and we know that about 0.1% of the total energy density is in the form of radiation now. As we go back in time, the energy density in the radiation increases relative to that in the matter and dark energy. And then we get to the point about a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang, where the energy densities are equal, and before that, radiation essentially dominates. In the Big Bang picture, as we go earlier, nothing really happens. We have just like higher temperatures in the universe. And the only interesting moments are the moments where we have some kind of phase transition or some kind of interactions coupled from the thermal bath. If there were not these moments, basically we have kind of a conformally invariant theory. So expansion, was not like physically important. We could always rescale things. So this is what happens in the Big Bang. We have the thermal bath from the very early moments until nowadays, and the temperature only decreases. However, the standard Big Bang has shortcomings of acidic problems, and that was the reason why inflation was introduced. According to inflation, there are different stages in the history of the early universe. The first stage is inflation. So somehow you get inflation, either in field theory models or brain world or string theory. All you need is to have some kind of energy density which is almost constant and drives an exponential expansion of the universe. So this solves these kind of problems like flatness, isotropy, and relative problems by rapid expansion. And it also creates the seed that we need for the structure formation. That's like the freezing of quantum fluctuations. On the other hand, the rapid expansion also makes the universe cold at empty. So there is basically nothing. We have zero entropy. We have energy density dominated by some kind of a constant potential. And the second stage, which is the exit from this inflationary epoch, in the second stage we have again some kind of inflation domination, at least in the field theory models for a while. So we have a condensate which is oscillating, dominating the energy density of the universe. But we know that matter should be created at some stage. And we need to have a transition from this inflaton-dominated universe to hot Big Bang, which is a thermal bath of elementary particles. And exactly this is the transition from 2 to 3, which is called reheating. and matter created during this transition. White is speaking, reheating consists of two steps. The first step is the inflow and decay. If this oscillating condensate does not decay, it has not couplings to other particles, nothing happens. It will be there, it is just oscillating and being registered by the expansion, there is nothing. So inflow must decay, or what we have energy density which drop inflation, it must decay. And then the decay products must thermalize. So I will describe a bit later what I really mean by the full thermal equilibrium state. So it is possible to have different processes, but they can still be kind of categorized in these two classes. So we have some kind of a decay process and some kind of a thermalization process. It could repeat several times in different forms. And the reheating itself and the dynamics during the reheating is very important. It has important implications for cosmology. For example, how we really trace back the CMB fluctuations to the inflationary epoch, because all we are interested is like to see at which point during the inflation these fluctuations were created. So the evolution of the physical wavelength depends on the equation of state of the fluid which fills the universe. And of course, the equation of state can change and can have different forms during the reheating, so depending on what we have. So this is very important. And secondly, it's been proposed in recent years that essentially all of the cosmological perturbations, called adiabatic perturbations, can be generated during the reheating itself. So this reheating stage is very important for cosmology, and it also has important implications for particle physics models. In models of particle physics, beyond the standard model, there are many, usually there are many stable or long-lived particles. And during the reheating, you can produce these particles thermally or non-thermally. So after a thermal bath is established, you can produce such particles from scatterings in the thermal bath, or during the thermalization, there are various processes so you may be able to produce the particles non-thermally. And it is also this is the reason why the knowledge of reheating is important for constraining particle physics models. So what are the constraints on the reheating temperature of the universe? I define the reheating temperature of the universe as the largest temperature at which we have a thermal bath at full equilibrium. So what are the constraints? The only real model independent and solid bound which exists from the observation is that a thermal bath at full equilibrium must be formed at a temperature around MeV or higher. And that is from the considerations considering the Big Bang nuclear synthesis predictions, the synthesis of white elements in the early universe. That is known to not tolerate any deviation from thermal equilibrium. So when you compare the predictions with the observation, so we certainly need to have a thermal bath to be present at such a temperature. But before that, I mean, there is no real kind of a solid reason to believe a thermal bath existed. Of course, there are some other more model-dependent bounds, like theoretical considerations. For example, if you want to generate the matter-antimatter asymmetry from an existing thermal bath, if you believe in electronic diagenesis, you want to make it work, then you need the reheating temperature to be at least larger than the 100 GeV electronic scale. If you believe in some like electrodiagenesis models starting from a thermal bath, then you need even much higher temperatures, 10 to the 9 GeV. And also, if you look at the weakest models with the weakest scale supersymmetry breaking, where you have a gravitino, which is the superpartner of graviton, typically mass of order TeV, then you need the reheating to be lower than 10 to the 10 GeV, otherwise you produce too many gravitinos, which, as I will explain later, I mean, would be dangerous. So there are also some bounds, but these are actually model dependent, and you can always invent some kind of a model that circumvents these. For example, you can have a late stage of entropy release from K of some particle such that, I mean, these bounds are kind of circumvented. So what I consider here is I'm considering a decaying scalar field, which I call the inkwoton. It has a mass m phi. And for the reasons I'm going to mention shortly, I assume that this decay is perturbative. Perturbative means I simply have a one particle decay. So you can pick any like quantum physics theory or particle physics book and simply read the decay rate for scalar to two fermions or three scalars. So why is it valid? Why is it valid actually? In the field theory models, we have a condensate. The inkwoton is a condensate which decays. So initially, this condensate was treated as a collection of a zero-moment quantum. And then people considered the decay, kind of the independent decay of these quanta, so there is no correlation. That was the story until the mid-90s, where people noticed actually the decay of a condensate can be a much, much more complicated process. And the reason is that if the condensate has a moderate or rather a strong coupling to other fields, when you decay to those fields, then you also have correlation among the decay products. And then you can build on the automation number of the decay products. So it's going to be a kind of a stimulated process if you have like bosons in the final state. It could be a very rapid process and not perturbative. So in many cases, the initial stage of the decay, it goes by a non-perturbative process, which is a complicated process, sometimes called preheating. However, this coupling is not very large, it is rather small. Basically, you can imagine that when you produce some quanta from the decay of the condensate, then the expansion of the universe redshifts them. And then there is no correlation between those quanta and the quanta which are produced a little bit later. So in that case, basically, this correlation does not exist. And you can really proceed with a one particle decay process. And in which cases you have a naturally small coupling of this inkwoton field to the other fields? One is when you have like inkwoton in a hidden sector, which is only gravitationally coupled to other fields. So in this case, you have very small couplings, gravitational couplings, and Planck's of this. This is in the context of field theory. If you go to brain world or string theory kind of models, for example, there are these kind of brainward models of inflation with the theta compactification. You don't have really an inflation, you have just the bulk which will stabilize the size. And it, as it was shown by Lev Kopman and collaborators, it was shown that basically in the radion zero mode, you have kind of a tachyonic instability. So basically, you have inflation on the brain, but because of this instability, the extra dimension wants to shrink. And then when it is stabilized, you kind of excite the bulk modes, like the radion and the scalar field. So in that case, what is really relevant is the transfer of the energy from those excited bulk fields to the matter on the brain. And in this case, again, the droplets are kind of gravitational and very small. So this is, again, like kind of a perturbative decay. Or in brain and brain models of inflation, which Keith is working on, the last stage of the energy transfer is from KK modes of the graviton to the matter on the standard model brain. And this is, again, kind of a perturbative decay. So in many cases, you may have a perturbative decay all the way along. And here, I don't want to describe, but even if initial stage, you have a large coupling, if the initial stage is non-perturbative, you can show that if this condition is satisfied, and the last you have a last stage of perturbative decay of the inkwoton quanta. So basically, I'm focusing on perturbative decay. And this is the condition that I need. To remind, if we have full equilibrium, The total energy density is related to the temperature, and the total number density is related to the temperature. Why are these expressions? So energy density is energy, is the temperature to the power of 4, and the number is substantial to the power of 2 if I have relativistic particles. Average energy is 3 times the temperature. So the number density is proportional to average energy to the power of 30. But what is the situation after perturbative decay with this condition? You can show that the energy density at this time is related to the decay rate and the planet mass via this expression. And since I consider just a one particle decay, the number is just energy density divided by the typical energy, which is just the entropy mass. The momenta of the decay products are just half of the entropy mass. And then if you replace this here, it turns out that you have a plasma where the number density is much, much smaller than the average energy to the power of 30. So you have a volume plasma which consists of a small number of very energetic particles. So this this is certainly the situation far from thermal equilibrium. Of course, the composition of the plasma is model dependent because it depends on like what is the dominant decay mode of the entropy, which particle decay to dominantly. But there are some general considerations. For example, if you have an inflaton or whatever field which decays is a standard model singlet, then you have to produce particles which are in the same irreducible representation of the gauge group. You have to produce the same amount of them. This is because like a gauge invariance. Or if you consider the case where the scale of supersymmetric breaking is much smaller than the mass of the inflaton, you have to produce the scalars and bosons associated with the same superfield in almost the same and with almost the same abundance. But the more detailed composition of the plasma is certainly a model-dependent issue. But as I will show, it is not a really important for the processes which lead to thermalization. So roughly speaking, one can quantify the deviation from thermal equilibrium through the parameter A, which is the number density divided by third power of average energy. From the previous slide, I mean, it can be shown that in the case after the decay, the number density divided by the number density, if things were already in full equilibrium, this ratio is 8 to the power of 1/4, and the ratio of the average energy is 8 to the power of minus 1/4. So A is a very small factor of inflaton decay, so you have a small number of particles with large average energies. Let us consider a simple example when we have a gravitationally coupled inflaton. So the inflaton mass is 10 to the 13 GeV, for example, the simplest chaotic models, in order to obtain the correct amount of density perturbations. And the decay rate is roughly speaking given by this formula. So if you replace things here, then it turns out that K is over 10 to the minus 12. In full equilibrium, K is over 1 here is 10 to the minus 12. So it means that we need to increase the total number of particles by a factor of 1,000 in this example. So how is the evolution for full equilibrium? Full equilibrium means kinetic equilibrium and chemical equilibrium. So I assume no chemical potential. For example, I assume the baryon symmetry is conserved and so on. So the number conserving processes, what do? They do not change the total number of particles. They just redistribute the energy among the particles. So these are certainly necessary, but not sufficient in order to reach equilibrium, because I have to increase the total number of particles by a large factor. So I also need number vibrating processes in order to build full equilibrium. What it means, I have to identify the most relevant such processes calculate the rates and then compare the rates with the Hubble expansion rate. When the rate for a given process is aborted, the Hubble expansion rate, this process is efficient in the cosmological timescale, like the relevant timescale, which is the inverse of the expansion rate. And then things will happen very efficiently. In general, there are three timescales involved. One is the timescale for rainfall and decay, for kinetic equilibrium to be established, and for food equilibrium to be established. So, just telling you a little bit of the history. Initially, people, if you look at the literature, people are assuming that if the inflow and decay products have gauge interactions, and thermalization is very fast because they have gauge interactions. But on the other hand, as I showed, you have a very small number of particles, so the processes are kind of suppressed because the rate for the processes depends on the number density of the particles. The less number you have, the number of particles you have, it is more difficult for the particles to find each other and lead to a given process. For example, the most relevant processes for the kinetic equilibrium and the chemical equilibrium in general are these processes. Consider any two fermions. So these two fermions can centrifugate boson.
Can you lower the slide? We can't see.
Oh, sorry. So these are basically just exchange energy between the fermion 1 and fermion 2. And this is a number conserving process. In order to increase the number of particles, this is the lowest order process. So you have two fermions producing also a third particle. And it turns out you can show that the really most relevant processes are those with the gauge boson exchange and the gauge boson production of the gauge boson. If you naively estimate the cross section for these processes based just on dimensional graphs, and if you say just the cross section is 1 over energy squared, like the center of mass energy squared, if you put that in the calculations, it turns out that actually, I mean, the processes are really inefficient until the later times. Because initially you have a very large energy, and also for the rate you have to multiply by the number density, so you have a small number density, large energy, so you have a kind of a small rates. But this is a well-known, I mean, it's not very actually difficult to show that for these processes, actually the cross-section is much larger than the naive estimate. And I don't explain it, but I mean, it is strictly related to the fact that you have gauge boson exchange. Well, basically, it is nothing but like you have this kind of, in the Rutherford scattering, you have this infrared divergence. It's exactly like that.
I mean, it's logarithmically enhanced, or it's like a 1 over t?
1 over t, yeah, exactly.
So, for kinetic equilibrium, you compare the elastic scattering rate with the Hubble rate?
Exactly.
But it's not the right thing to do. Wouldn't you want to compare the relaxation time with the Hubble time?
Sure. Eventually, we have to really compare the relaxation time. So, what is really more relevant is this process, because you have to also include, create more and more particles.
So, because it's just if you have, even if you would have much more particles, your relaxation process could still be very inefficient because the interaction with the heat valve are extremely weak, like for super weakly interacting particles.
Sure, here I have, exactly. Here I have, I consider basically particles with gauge interaction. So I consider like atom bubble particles. If you have extremely weakly interacting particles, like, I mean, the gadolinium, for example, it will never reach equilibrium energy. So this simple fact was kind of underlined about like in 2005 years ago, that after the perturbative decay, if you have particles with gauge interactions in the plasma, then the equilibrium is established very quickly indeed because of this property.
So there are probably some universal estimates for the cross section depending on the spin of the exchanging particle, right? So for spin one, it would be the largest, right? For spin 1/2, it would be the second largest.
Exactly.
For a spin, it should be a generic thing.
Exactly. the spin half is the second largest. Instead of 1 over 3, it is 1 over s, center of mass energy squared. If you consider the spin 0, which is the scalar extent, it is even smaller than that. It is 1 over s times some ratio, which is the mass of the particles divided by the energy. Yeah, exactly. So it is a kind of a weight hierarchically, I mean, from spin 1 exchange to spin 0. So if you incorporate these, then you find that taking that into account, the rate for thermalization, here I mean by rate for thermalization the 2 to 3 processes, it's given by this formula. And alpha is a finite structure constant, a finite structure constant. So if you choose typical values like 10 to the minus 2, and inflow mass is less than 10 to the 13 GeV, then it turns out that the thermalization rate, like 2 to 3 processes, is larger or of the same order of the decay rate of the inflow. So that is the reason why, in that case, you have really very quick thermalization. Once you decay, the processes are so efficient that they leave your thermal bath.
Why does it depend on inflow?
The end time is basically just determines like the energy density at that point, and the energy density divided by the energy's number density. So the gamma depends on the number density, and then because if you remember, the energy density was gamma t squared plus Planck squared.
So you're trading the number density for the energy density for the Hubble scale.
Exactly.
Log Planck.
Yeah. Exactly. And then once the things are thermalized, you can calculate the temperature of the thermal bath, nothing but roughly speaking, the energy density to the power of 1/4, the 4th root of that, and then this is the real temperature. And the real temperature, I mean, for the example of a gravitationally decaying inflaton, you get things of order 10 to the 10 GeV. However, what I'm going to show is that thermalization could still be very slow if you take into account of supersymmetry. So what is the key factor in the supersymmetry? In supersymmetric theories and also string theories, you have a large number of moduli. So for example, you have modules for, I mean, getting, I mean, those from, I mean, the compactification manifold, I mean, the size, the shape, you have the Dubatov, you have the modulus for the supersymmetry grating sector, and so on. So these are basically, they have no potential at all. They only get kind of a mass term after supersymmetry is broken. So these are really flat directions in the field space. However, one problem with these is that they are also very deeply coupled kind of gravitationally, so they are cosmologically dangerous. However, in SUSY, you also have flat directions or the moduli field, which roughly speaking are a linear combination of scalar fields which have gain interactions. Because in SUSY, for every fermion, standard model fermion, you have to introduce also a boson, the scalar field. And these scalar fields have exactly the same quantum numbers. So for quarks, you have some scalar quarks, or leptons, you have scalar leptons, and so on. And it turns out that you have about 300 flat directions for 300 modulus fields, which are independent and built from these scalar particles with gauge interactions. So in that case, these kind of moduli or flat directions are not really cosmologically dangerous because they decay sufficiently early. But what do they do, actually? Since flat directions or the moduli have a mass of order SUSY breaking scale, for example, if you consider the weak scale supersymmetry, the masses are typically of order 1 GeV. So cosmologically, these scalar fields are very large. Cosmologically, I mean to compare the mass with the scale of inflation, for example, 10 to the 13 GeV. Once this happens, they can develop a large Planck expectation value during inflation. So it can happen in two ways. If you this is a just MCU squared, breaking the squared, I call it MZO times a phi squared. Since these things are very light, then the quantum fluctuations can accumulate in a random walk process. And then eventually you reach to the point where this random walk stops, because roughly speaking, you have a diffusion because of the accumulation of the fluctuations versus the drift from the classical force. And at that point, the web starts its increase. So this is one way you can increase the web, you can obtain a web, a large web for this field. Or in some models, during inflation, your Keller function is such that you get a large mass squared, which is minus h pi squared. H pi is the Hubble constant due to inflation, pi squared. And in that case, whenever you start field phi, which is like this modulus field or the flat direction, then you have a cyclic instability, so the wave rapidly increases. So basically, during inflation, you can obtain large vacuum expectation values for your modulus in general, and in particular for these moduli field of squares and stepwise. So what does this vacuum expectation value do? So I call this phi zero. Whatever. Obviously, you need to stabilize it at some point. So it depends on like higher order operators. So what higher order operators are relevant? Since these fields carry gauge quantum numbers, just the same as in the Higgs mechanism, they break, the spontaneously break the gauge symmetries. And then they induce a large mass, which is of order their vacuum expectation value for the gauge fields and gauge units. So what does this mean? It means that if you look at the relevant processes, you have a natural physical cutoff for these exchange k photons, which is nothing but their mass induced by the modulus width. And once you replace the masses which are induced in the formulas, it turns out that thermalization rate is actually suppressed. So quantitatively, the rate for the thermalization is now suppressed by the second power of the web of this flat direction. Well, of course, dmn0 is the mass of the modulus, which is just the speed breaking scale in the standard model sector. Well, obviously, one has to worry about the fate of this vacuum expectation value, because if it stays around, then we know it is inconsistent, because then it means that gauge symmetries are very badly broken today. And on top of that, since these are like leptons and like lepton number and value number, value number, variation, but this is not actually the case, because like any other scalar field which has a like expectation value, the oscillation starts once the Hubble rate is of order the mass of the scalar field. And after that, these particles start oscillating, the field starts oscillating, the vacuum expectation value is redshifted, decreasing. At some point, it just decays into the standard model particles because it has gauge interactions. So basically, what you need to put in the expression for the thermalization rate is the expectation value as a function of time. So before oscillation, it is almost constant. After oscillation, it is redshifting. So these will be taken into account. So actually,
is
So here with thermalization, you really mean mechanical equilibrium, because for kinetic equilibrium, everything depends on the average momentum transfer, which is still huge, yep. Right?
Sure.
Because we have to compare the temperature of the relativistic particles with the mass of the gauge bosons,
exactly.
And that's still huge.
Yep.
So I mean, that's chemical equilibrium.
Exactly, chemical equilibrium. Exactly. So given that, you can find the real temperature from this expression, and just as you expect, the reheat temperature basically depends on the rate for chemical equilibrium, not for the influx and decay rate. In a sense, your influx can decay very early on, but nothing can happen for a long time. So basically, you have a dilute plasma which is there, and it is only subject to a redshift because of the expansion. And the full equilibrium, or basically the chemical equilibrium, is only built much later when the processes become efficient. In order to give an example, the initial web of the modulus field can be anywhere between the inflaton mass and the Planck mass. The inflaton mass, or roughly speaking, the Hubble rate during inflation, is the typical size of the quantum fluctuations which freeze. So basically, I mean, whatever you build, I mean, is certainly of order inflaton mass 4, greater, you cannot have a smaller. And it could be even n Planck, because it very much depends on the higher order operators which stabilize the potential. So for example, if you have some kind of R symmetry or some kind of like kind of discrete R symmetry appropriate bonds, then you can prevent such higher order terms appearing at the superpotential level. They only appear through the Taylor terms, and those are really only important around n Planck. So in that case, it is possible to have a very large vector expectation damage. And to show the impact of a late thermalization, if I start with large expectation value of order n Planck, then it turns out that my free temperature is really small, of order 10, of order 1 T. For a smaller expectation values, this will be larger. But in this range, what you find is something between 1 TeV and 10 to the 5 times the 6 TeV. So it means no matter how inflaton decays, the reheat temperature is much, much smaller than the dynamic expectation. So why is it important? For two reasons. The difficult situation is the following. The inflaton decay rate is much larger than the rate for kinetic equilibrium, and the kinetic equilibrium, the rate for that is much larger than the rate for chemical equilibrium. So what it really means, just after the inflaton decay, you have some number of particles with kind of energies peaked around the inflaton mass divided by 2 or something like that, depending on whether it's 1, 2 particle decay, or 2 particle decay final state. So between this time and this time, these particles just freely move around, nothing really happens, because still the energy exchange is not efficient. So the average energy and the average number density co-moving values remain constant. Around this time, you have some kind of a kinetic equilibration, but the average energy of the particles is still constant, right? Because I have not changed the number of particles. So it basically just distributes the energy in each particle kind of in a thermal manner. But still the total number of particles remain constant. At much, much later time, I start to increase the number of particles, which is what I really need in order to establish full equilibrium. So what it really means is that we have a long period where nothing really interesting happens. And it turns out that this period spans over a wide range of temperatures and energies which are relevant for many processes which are associated with the production of particles such as the gravitinos, etc. So here I just show you some like a result. Basically, during this epoch, you can relate your number density to the average energy or temperature through these relations where A is much less than 1, as I mentioned earlier. So if you want to estimate the production of particles, you have to really use these expressions for the those expressions for the number density, energy density, and the whole expansion rate.
So, excuse me? When you compare your rates with the Hubble rate, let's say, do you assume anything about the time dependence of A?
Well, the total A is basically constant until the chemical equilibrium is established, because the total A is related to the total number of particles, like a commuting number. And that does not change for a long time. So basically, it means that you have A constant for a long time and then sharply increasing at around the gamma thermalization. But of course, A is not the sum of all A's for different degrees of freedom. So the sum is constant, but each could change because it means kind of a relative chemical equilibrium. So the relative chemical equilibrium doesn't change the total number of particles, but the number of particles in each degree of freedom. So the sum is constant until very late times, but of course the individual contributions can change. So as long as I'm concerned with the total number, it's almost kind of a constant quantity. Thanks a lot. So the bottom line is that I can calculate the particle production during this phase because I have the number density, I have like the Hubble rate, whatever. One point to note is that I have to really, okay, we know that we usually normalize every number density with the entropy density in cosmology to get some kind of a dimensionless expressions. For example, for the gravitino, for the dark matter, for the barium asymmetry. For the entropy density, I have to use the final entropy after full thermalization. Actually, the situation is like that. You start with the frozen state, the condensing, no entropy. Then it means that some entropy is released at the first stage, which is the inflow and decay. But then there is no more entropy produced. It is not a full entropy release. Then you wait for a long time, and then you have the second bulk of entropy release, and there you get to the state with maximum entropy. Mm-hmm. So I have to use that maximum entropy to normalize my number density. So I mean, we know like how to calculate the production of particles and so on. Here, I only give you an example of the gravitino, which is really important. For the gravitino, the cross-section, the production cross-section goes as 1 over m times squared, where it is like nothing but the superposition of the graviton, so it's gravitationally coupled. And then if you calculate how many gravitinos you produce after full equilibrium and how many gravitinos you produce during that long phase where nothing happens, you end up with these two expressions. So this is heat over 10 to the 10. This is the maximum temperature or maximum energy that you reach in this long phase. And this is A, the factor A to the power of the 3/4. The worst case scenario for the gravitinos is where they have a mass of order 10 B. Because in that case, they decay so late that their decay products can destroy the light elements which are produced during the Big Bang nuclear synthesis. And then we have very strict bounds from that concentration. So it turns out that depending on the decay mode of the gravitino, you need the total number of gravitinos normalized by the entropy density to be somewhere between 10 to the minus 16 and 10 to the minus 12. So if you incorporate this into these expressions, it means that we need, roughly speaking, a theory heat which is less than, at least less than 10 to the 10 GeV. For a late thermalization, this is naturally satisfied because you get a temperature between 1 GeV and 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6. And again, if you incorporate this into this expression, it turns out that for inflationary models, this is also usually satisfied. All you need to have quantity A to be less than 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 4 in this range. And for example, for that gravitationally decaying inflow, I got A to the minus 10 to the minus 12, which is well in the acceptable region. So before just moving quickly to some comments about preheating and also some comments about what can be for what may be done for the brain under brain inflation. Here, what I'm suggesting is that it is very well known for a long time that the supersymmetry theory is weak essential supersymmetry, which is attractive for particle physicists. It has this kind of generally, it has this cosmological gravitational problems. What I'm suggesting here is that this supersymmetry also provides a built-in solution in the form of those kind of flat directions built up the squares as leptons, etc. And if one really treats the thermal history of the universe properly, taking into account the impact of these kind of moduli, then basically you have a built-in solution which can prevent the gravitational problem. So you don't need any kind of further modifications, such as a latent foot release to dilute the gravitons and so on. It may very well be that if you treat the thermal history with care, basically you don't get any gravitational problem at the first place. Yes.
When you calculated the total number of gravitons per entropy, did you assume something in solving the kinetic equation that you are close to chemical equilibrium, or did you solve them exactly?
Well, I assume that I am in full equilibrium, including chemical equilibrium, after thermalization completes. So then I calculate things in that range, in that regime. Then I also assume a regime where there is only kind of equilibrium but not full equilibrium, and then I also calculate the things which are produced in that regime. So in the kind of the intermediate regime, I mean, you find something, I mean, in between. But as long as they both kind of respect the bound, you also expect that whatever, I mean, in the intermediate regime happens also respects, I mean, the bound. So let me just briefly comment on the situation after preheating, which is a non-perturbative decay. In that regime, what happens is the opposite of the situation after a perturbative decay. In that case, you have a very dense plasma, where the number density of particles is much larger than the number density in would-be equilibrium. And the average energies are much less than the average energy in the would-be equilibrium. So what it means that in order to reach full equilibrium, you have to decrease the number of particles and increase the average energy. The situation, however, is much more complicated and involved. You have large occupation numbers. And because of that, you have large effective masses. And when you have a very dense plasma, then basically you cannot really use these simple rates for the scatterings of different processes. You don't have asymptotic states. You can basically say that particles are basically all the time are optional. They are not functional. So it is a really more much more complicated. What you should really do is like to solve kind of quantum Boltzmann equations. It's kind of a quantum transport theory. It's much more complicated. Lev Kofman and his group has been working on that for a long time. So fortunately, what you can do is, because you have very large patient numbers, initially you can approximate things with the classical fields, bosons. And then you can basically follow the interaction between these classical fields with Gaussian distribution and see what happens. It has been shown that in that case, kinetic equilibrium also reached very quickly. But full equilibrium means the decrease in the number of particles, chemical equilibrium, it takes a much, much longer time. However, because of like the simulation, kind of constraints, they cannot go to very long times. But when they go, they find that basically full equilibrium is not established after a relatively long time. This approximation, however, inevitably breaks down at late times. Because once you decrease the number of particles, you also decrease the occupation numbers. So this classical approximation, the approximation with classical things, will not be valid at late times. So in that case, you really need to do a proper non-equilibrium quantum field theory treatment. And this has been done, for example, with Jürgen Berges and collaborators in Heidelberg. But they mainly consider this in the context of heavy ion collisions. But very well, the same methods, I mean, could be applied in principle, at least to this kind of thermalization after preheating. And finally, let me just comment on whether and how these considerations may be applied to like some brain and early brain inflation models. So Cliff has been working on that for a rather long time, and there was also some recent papers by Rob Myers and collaborators, and also Lev Kaufman and collaborators on the reheating in these phenomenal brain and brain inflation in work compact applications. So basically, there you have a colloquial with multiple throats, meaning at each throat you have a warp factor. So in one of the throats, which is called the inflationary throat, you basically have inflation in that throat. So basically you have an underbrain and a brain. And the warp factor is chosen such that you have the correct appropriate scale for inflation. So the fundamental, the effective string scale is of order 10 to the 13 GDB in that throat. So that's the warp factor you choose. And what happens is that these brain and underbrain slowly move toward each other, and that is exactly the period where the inflation happens. But when they get very close to each other, then you have a kind of a tectonic instability in the open string mode. So they basically annihilate very quickly. And when they annihilate, they produce massive closed string modes. These are basically like kind of massive modes of the graviton. And then with cascade decay, you decay to lighter closed string modes, and then eventually to take in modes in the inflationary throat. And then you have to wait for some time in order to tunnel to the other throat, which you introduce in order to incorporate this kind of model in your theory. So that has a larger warp factor, or basically a deeper throat, so the effective string scale is 10 to the 3 GDB. And eventually, once they take a mode, decay to that throat, then they decay to the matter, and that's the last stage. So the reheating is really more involved in this. However, the considerations which are probably important or worth looking at is these KK modes, for example, in the recent paper by Hoffman, based on very simple estimates, they find that these KK modes in the inflationary throat thermal, so they reach a thermal kind of equilibrium, real full thermal equilibrium. However, this should really be considered in more detail because, as I mentioned, for any full thermal equilibrium, you really need to have number of rating interactions to be efficient. So a 2 to 2, for example, 2 graviton going to 2 graviton interaction, it is good and required for kinetic equilibrium. But for full equilibrium, you have to really find how many KK modes you produce, and then what really happens from them. And obviously, you also need to see where the thermalization completes after the KK modes in the standard model throw decay to the matter. Because, for example, in the paper, recent paper by Rob Myers and collaborators, they found that if you really assume instant thermalization, you get temperatures which are much larger than the effective string scale. So basically, it means that what you have is just a string phase. I mean, you have like a phase where you have like lots of like kind of strings. So you cannot really use, I mean, the field theory there. But then again, I mean, it depends on whether after you take really reach full equilibrium or not. The situation can be very different. So these are possible directions which one may follow in this context. To quickly wrap up with the conclusion, in general, thermalization is a very slow process in the context of supersedent. It has been known that it is slow after preheatings, but even after preheatings, when things seems to be much easier, still thermalization can be very slow. And basically, you have two phases, three phases: the inflaton decay, long phase, nothing happens, and then establishment of full equilibrium at very late time. And this affects the particle production, obviously. And probably the main message was the gravitational production in general is well under control. No matter how early the inflaton decay is or how large the inflaton mass is. And finally, it is in principle interesting to see these considerations, how I mean they can modify The picture of reheating in other cases, for example, is right under the penetration model. And that's it for us.
I imagine you'll say there's no scope for thermal inflation in this kind of supersymmetric model. So the idea is always a thermal background during inflation.
Well, I mean, yeah, if your thermal, if your build temperature is really low, then you cannot really get into that.
So what kind of feedback do you think is might have into production of fluctuation? Probably none of these things.
Well, it cannot, in principle, okay, let me explain. As I mentioned earlier, there have been proposals that fluctuations basically may have been created during the reheating. And that is exactly related to the change in the equation of the state of the fluid. Because
so is this like a stellar field quantization kind of usual scenario with fluctuations?
Yeah, this is all post-inflationary. So it does not really affect at all on the evolution of fluctuations during inflation.
Okay, so it's just afterwards.
Yeah, but it may well, I mean, affect the evolution.
So you said it's going to cause a potential to decay or something like that.
Exactly.
Can you remind me of this model of Rob-Meyer's and collaborators? What is the relation between the mass gap of the Klotzer-Klein modes and the string scale? I mean, is it large or small?
I do not remember the details, but I think the mass gap should be less than the string scale. In other words,
but could it be much smaller than the string scale? Or?
That I'm not sure.
Because in that case, it wouldn't be enough to calculate tree-level processes, right? If the mass gap is very small compared to the typical energy scale, you would have to do calculations.
You mean for which process?
That doesn't matter where, because the degeneracy between the Kaluza-Klein moves, if you want to resolve that, you really have to do very precise calculation, and then a tree-level calculation might be not enough. Only in the case if this mass gap is very much smaller than the string scale. I don't remember that, but
at least as far as I remember from the Kaufman paper, they say it is smaller, but not much smaller.
Oh.
But I think I'm not sure whether all these steps are really kind of very solid or kind of these are just some initial work starting like to see how it really happens. But I'm not sure. Please, these are experts, so.
I think it's true, as I understand that picture, that the string scale set by the warping in that probe, and it's also due to the lowest Klotz Klein mode, it's getting set by the warping in that same probe, so they're not so different from one another.
Oh, that's true. Okay.
I have a question. But you say something about left of baryogenesis. You seem to have everything in the broken phase, so sort of naively, your Sparrow rate should be zero.
Well, it actually, okay, there are two possibilities. I mean, whether, I mean, this guy completely dominates energy density or not, because if it dominates, then basically the situation is different. But even if it does not dominate, since your gauge speeds are very nasty, then the scalar rates will be kind of very suppressed. But the only point is that at the relevant time, I mean, how large this bed is or how large the gauge mass, kind of the gauge speed mass is. I mean, if I have not really taken, I mean, considered that, but obviously if these are still large at the relevant time for like conversion of lepton divided asymmetry, obviously. But again, you can assume that you produce some lepton number and then wait until much later when, I mean, these guys are settled to get the conversion from the servers. And as long as it happens before like GDV, it's fine. So you may wait for a while, I mean, in order to convert. So you produce, but do not convert right away, as in the standard scenario. But
if you go straight from this phase to the electric phase, normal phase, you won't have anything.
Exactly. So if I mean, you don't have really kind of a full equilibrium before electric phase transition, the situation will be very different.
Well, if no further questions, thank you.
And that's it.